You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CivCast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new episode of CivCast. My name is Kyle, and I'm joined here by my co-host, as always, Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hello, sir.
How are you doing on this wonderful post-DLC week?
I mean, I was going to say I had kind of a meh week, but it finally happened. DLC finally came, so that definitely helps.
It's so exciting. And Valter, how was your week made by this wonderful news?
A lot more busy because I had, of course, to play a lot more Civilization VI all of a sudden.
What turned out, so we took a weekend off last weekend because, Dan, you were traveling. We had a little, like, state holiday here in Utah, and it worked out to be perfect because we come back fresh and renewed for this awesome news. It had been a long time coming. It had been a pretty long drought without any new leaders being added, any new scenarios, anything like that. And just to think, we've got another one coming down the pipe at some point in the near future. So not only do we have something to be excited about today, but we've also got something to kind of look forward to in the weeks/months to come. Who knows?
But months.
Probably months. So we got, what's her name? How do you say it?
Amanator, Amanator. The fantastic narrator of that first look pronounced it that way.
So, yes. Yeah. Amanator of Nubia. So we're going to kind of do like a gloss over of her and her traits later on, a little bit later down the episode. And then we're going to come back next week with even more information about her, how to kind of max out her play style. Dan's got some history on her, just a little bit that's out there. Valter's planning some tips. But first, let's go ahead and dive into July's CivCast Challenge, because we got to wrap that baby up and you can get some new rules next week. Dan, what's it look like?
It looks great. And thank you to everyone who participated. So, we set, you know, specific parameters with the intention of trying to gear you towards a different play style, a different approach, and obviously a different starting age with the Renaissance start and everything. But we also tried to keep it, open. We tried to keep it interesting, allowed you to pick which civ you wanted to go with. And we definitely had some variety in that sense. And we had some people whose feedback really speaks to the advantages and disadvantages of the civs around this point in the game. First and foremost, Durgrick played Australia, and he mentioned in his post on the challenge, which is it's a very long and large post, how he had a couple challenging first takes, challenging first shots at the challenge, but I think it was his third chance. He finally made it happen, a religious victory with Australia on turn 559. And he mentions, and I don't know if you guys can attest to this, I know that in my game I can, that Australia, the Renaissance era is the perfect place to start with Australia, because that's when you start really spamming out the Outback stations. Just a heads up for everyone that with this, you start on turn, I think it's 290, I think was the turn you started on, is that right?
That sounds about right.
241 or something like that, but yeah, something around there.
Yeah, something in the mid to late 200s. So a lot of these victories... 291, okay, yeah. So a lot of these victories are in the late 400s to early 500s. Durgrick had turned 559 because he had some challenges, it looked like. And, you know, I think that Australia, although we talk a lot about how they're overpowered, it looks like he kind of got boxed into a really strong military-focused game, and that can maybe be a bit of a challenge in that situation with Australia when you're going up against aggressive civs. Resender, who is another frequenter of both the podcast and the challenge, completed a religious game on turn 467. He went random, and lucky him, he got Saladin, who, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, is just about the best religious victory opportunity you can get. So turn 467 means that he completed it in about 150 turns, which is fantastic. Someone who completed it even quicker is our friend Yonker 451, who played my personal favorite civ for a religious game, which is Jadwiga in Poland. He finished on turn 425, actually, which is intense. I mean, that's only about 130 turns, I guess, to get a victory. And remember, it was six civs. So, you know, he didn't mess around. There was no small feat there. So I think that is, I think that's testament both to how good Yonker is at the game, but also to how viable Jadwiga is in that era and with that victory type. Just kind of doubling down on that. I know we had that discussion a couple weeks ago as well. Okay, deep breath. Okay, and then we had Pendon, who I think has been participating in the last two or three Civcast challenges. He or she completed with the Aztecs a religious victory, which I've never done. I haven't beaten a game of Civ 6 with the Aztecs yet. I mean, my bias towards them is under the assumption that they're an early game Civ, but you know, Pendon seems to have done a pretty fantastic job with it, and his or her write-up demonstrates that. And again, I'm not going through all these write-ups here, folks, because you know, all you guys and gals who posted your write-ups on the thread, they are all fantastic. And I was looking briefly at them, and I'm going to try and look more into them as time goes by here. But the fact that you're posting them and getting other people within the community to interact with them is the whole point of this. So please continue to post them, even if we don't detail them step by step, because I think they're great, and I know we all appreciate them.
Well said, Dan.
Thank you. another frequenter of these challenges is Zoom WSU, and he went with, well, of course, my personal favorite in general, which is Peter the Great and Russia, and was victorious on turn 457. Interestingly enough, he, and I don't know if this was meant to be ironic or anachronistic or just straight up trolly, but he did call his religion Make America Great Again, and he was playing Russia, so... I don't know. I don't know if we're going to see. I think we'll just leave that one as is, because Zoom is a good dude and we appreciate him always submitting to us and talking to us on Reddit. So to each their own. Moving on from there, we did have three folks who were kind enough to submit their first challenges. The first was Rayim, I'm probably mispronouncing it, R-A-Y-M 84120. Who completed a religious victory with Saladin on turn 512. And again, Ryan posted a really cool kind of update on it, and with a little bit of the nuance of his game. And it sounded like it was one of the more kind of difficult games. And he posted a screenshot for us as well of it. So we really appreciate that. Keep doing that. Drockman or Dr. Ockman, I don't know where to go with that.
You're doing good.
Whatever. It's one of the two, I think. Or maybe it's... Da Rockman. Yeah, it could be that. You know, it could be a big Dwayne Johnson fan.
Da Rockman. I see. I'm gonna get
it. He went with a Civ that I would never personally choose for a religious victory, and that's England. and he was victorious on turn 541. So Kyle, it can be done.
You can't see me beating my heart here. It's someone after my heart.
No, but the point is it can be done, sir. You can play a religious game with Victoria and have
could,
a good
time. Maybe. Should, won't. Go ahead.
But only, you know, only if you get the skills of Dr. Ockman.
I don't.
Fair enough. and then last but not least, Dr. Stabback with one of the most interesting usernames for sure to submit to the Civcast challenge yet. He was victorious in turn 496 with the Aztecs, and he has... just to top it off, one of the coolest and most interesting and most detailed, and is a man after my heart, one of the most well-formatted Civcast challenge posts ever. And I really encourage you folks to go take a look at it, because he's got, you know, embedded links all throughout it. He's bolds the parts that are important, like when he takes big cities like St. Petersburg and Cairo and Aachen, and he... bolds all of the great people that he got and the focuses he went for. And it is just a really easy to read and really enjoyable to read post. So I believe this is the first time I've seen Dr. Stabback in the Civcast challenge. And the one thing, you know, that was uniform here as I wrap up and say thank you to everyone for participating, and that we will have new rules next week. The one thing is that I did see that pretty much to a man and or woman, everyone posted that this was new for them because they never would think to start in another era. And I do think, you know, we've talked about this in the past, when we talked about this when we were doing this, the tendency is just to start at the very beginning, right? I know that in like 98% of my games, that's what I do, because that's the point of Civ. Mm. So props to Wouter for, you know, for putting together something that gets people out of their comfort zone, gets them trying something new, because it did look like people had a lot of fun with it and it did take them out of their comfort zone and they learned a lot of new stuff. So props to you, sir. And thank you to everyone for participating.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, thanks very much. It was a great read, all those posts, and so many people wrote so detailed everything they did. It's awesome. Thank you so much, all.
I have to echo that. I mean, you guys put so much effort into these. These are not like whipped together posts at the last minute. You guys are going on Imgur and building out awesome stories or linking them all through. These are fantastic. Thank you so much to everyone that goes in there, chats with one another. This is a great way to share strategy tips just between yourselves and to see what someone else is doing. So I am so glad that Dan and Wouter have been championing the Civcast Challenge, because it is awesome. So thank you for the huge recap, Dan. That was amazing. Everyone go check that out. It is at the top of our subreddit. So that is civcast.reddit.com. You can find it stickied at the top. Like I said, we'll be back next week likely with new roles for August as we like barrel through this new year. So we've got some slightly big news to talk about this week. Go figure. There was a little like DLC thing, I think, that you guys may have heard about. And then there were some little patch notes, but I don't think those are important. Actually, we could just skip. Oh, wait. Actually, the patch notes. Let's tackle Nubia first in a brief overview so you guys can see what happened. If you haven't checked it out already, we got Nubia as a civilization. This is the one that they promised that was going to be from the African region. The next one is, I believe, from Southeast Asia. But we get Nubia, and with her, we get a scenario pack. So a Minotaur. No, am I saying that right? A Minotaure?
I
say it correctly in my head, and then I can't get it out of my mouth. But you just saw I failed to say regular words, so... Anyway, we are looking at an amazing leader who brings some really a very cool unique unit, especially for my liking. The Patati Archer is so much fun to play with. This archer has increased movement speed, so you're getting 3 versus 2. They have increased range strength. It looks like we're looking at 30 versus 25. Production cost is slightly higher, but not enough that I noticed any sort of hang-ups in any of my games. Have you guys tried this archer yet?
Definitely.
Thoughts, Wouter?
It's really good.
Okay, fair enough. Dan, did you get a chance to get in there and play Nubia?
Not yet. No, I haven't had the chance to, but that is going to be this week, early this week. Probably I'm going to get a game going.
Good. I think you're going to enjoy it. I mean, this archer is just great for early game blitzkrieging of cities. I mean, they just bulldoze from what I've played with. I mean, we're talking about taking out barbarians really, really quickly. So overall, a great archer. What else do we have here in terms of abilities? We get a bonus. She can build the Nubian pyramids. That is a tile improvement. So by putting those, you actually get a different bonus based on where you put it. So if it's next to a commercial hub, I believe it gives you +1 gold. If it's near a campus, you get science. If it's near your any of your cities, though, it gives you a boost towards building districts. So I believe she has a flat bonus of +20% to building districts, but by placing this Nubian pyramid there, it bumps it up to +40% production towards districts. Do I have that right, guys?
Yeah.
Cool. Good. I'm glad, because I'm kind of going off the cuff here with this. But overall, so these make for some really cool perks. She's also got something where when you get a bonus, that's the infrastructure. What do they call this one? This is the Civ unique ability, where she can put the, whenever you put a mine over something, a strategic resource or over a luxury resource, putting it over a strategic resource gives an extra point of production. Putting the mine over a luxury resource gives you extra gold. So those are really cool ways to supplement your flow of both income for, you know, fielding troops or just maintaining the empire. And then you're getting extra production for capping off those strategic resources. And she also gets a production bonus towards range units, period. Don't want to forget that one. Am I leaving anything out, guys? I feel like I am.
No, I think you got it all.
Okay, good. Then there you go. There is the Nubia overview. Does anyone have anything you want to add in this episode? I know we're going to come back with more strategy tips for them next week, but anything that's really stood out that you guys want to chime in on?
Yeah, we'll discuss it a little bit more in my this week's strategy tip. So I will keep my comments until then.
He is going to hold his tongue.
I think one thing I might do this week is that my first game with Nubia in the game, I might not actually play as them. I might play against them. Ooh. Just to try and kind of, you know, get a bit of a different approach to it. Because I know Voucher's got all areas covered playing as her. It might be interesting to see what it's like to play against her, maybe with a Civ that isn't such an early game beast.
Ah.
Yeah, that should be really interesting.
That is a good one. That's a very good idea, Dan. I like that. So now we get into the extra juicy stuff. Since we've agreed to hold our tongues on any of the firm details of how we play Nubia, then that means we have a lot of patch notes to talk about and some very important ones, too. So I'd like everyone to kind of chime in and give your thoughts as we go down the list here. But first, I wanted to start off with a very basic one. We got a restart button, finally! It's been baked into the game since, beta? But now it's finally unlocked after all those months of toiling over it. Almost a year later, we have a restart button. Has anyone actually used
this? I must say I'm a little bit sad with it.
See, I knew you were going to say that. Fired. I remember that you were hating on it.
Yeah.
You're fired.
Because, like I said before, people are going to reroll for that perfect start, kind of. And... I mean, I understand people want it and they should listen to the community, but I'm sad that people want it. That's probably it.
You're sad about me then, because even without a restart button, if I hate my start, I will still re-roll it. But boy, have they made it easier for me, because they have also added the ability to save game setup configurations to reuse when starting future games, which is something I don't think Civ 5 had, right? You always had to reconfigure every time.
I think so as well. And that is a change that is really great.
That will benefit everyone, even for the people that aren't just restarting for the primo setup. Yeah. Voucher, I'm sure you can get some value out of that if you're, you know, typically playing the same sort of things or the same sub roles. You can just pop those on. I haven't actually tried it yet, so I'm not sure how that feature looks in game. Have you saved anything or gotten that far?
I have a standard configuration save. You need to go to the advanced setup and you can save multiple configurations. You can name them, everything like that, and you can load them as well. So you can get the like same configuration setup all the time. It's really useful because I play on the kind of same configuration very often.
See benefits. Dan, are you excited for that?
Sure. I mean, it'll make it easier, I think.
Are you a restarter, Dan? Will you use this button?
Maybe if I'm really keen on doing a certain kind of game and I've set it up particularly and then it rolls me a really garbage setup, then maybe. But I kind of like rolling with the punches on it, man. I gotta be honest.
I'm
proud of you, Dan.
Yeah, yesterday playing Nubia, I was just like, whatever, especially because I don't even know what, you know, what I'm looking for yet with her. So I was like, okay, this is fine. I'll just, you know, take whatever it throws to me.
I guess it's, yeah, I mean, it's just, why would you want to always have a sweetheart setup, right? Like, sometimes 3/4 of the fun is into having a challenging, crappy setup and adjusting.
And that was exactly my point why people shouldn't want a restart button. You want to have yourself challenged in that game and actually, because that's when you improve the most. And people like improving in the game and being able to go to a higher difficulty. And if you always have that perfect start, you will never learn from your mistakes so much as when that really suboptimal start happens and you make the most out of it because you learned a couple of new tricks where you can completely optimize things that you were doing differently before.
That's interesting. That's a philosophical discussion for another day, so I'll save this, but I'll just add in, I don't play Civ to learn, and I think that's an interesting concept to unpack at some later date, is I just play it for a quick breeze through, like, entertaining afternoon, not necessarily to get better. So that's very interesting to remember that to discuss later. But going down this list, though, we just have a lot of balanced things to cover. Specifically, we were talking about aqueducts recently, right here at the top. They have reduced the cost by 30% and sewers by 50%. Do you think that this is actually going to make them any more interesting or useful than we set the bar pretty low for them previously? Are you building
them
now?
Well, I mean, to go to the next point a little bit, in comparison, other districts have also their costs being reduced by 10%. So the big difference is just 20% compared to other districts now. Mm-hmm. They're still worthless, pretty much. I mean, it gets them a little bit closer, but it's still not enough.
I agree. Increase the discount for districts you have less from 25 to 40. What does that mean? Do you actually understand what this one means, Valter? The following
so,
point?
For example, if you have a commercial hub in every city, mm-hmm. and you have zero campuses, uh-huh. that means that the campus gets an extra bonus discount for production costs compared to the commercial hub in the next city and stuff like that. So that way they try to force you or try to at least encourage you to have a little bit more of a balanced approach, that you build all kinds of districts throughout all your cities. And they encourage you to do that even more now by making it even cheaper.
Yep.
That's interesting. I didn't even notice that was a thing, that you were getting penalized for having more of one district over the others. But that does make sense.
See, it's not a penalty. It's just an encouragement like, hey, do you really not want to build this district? It's extra cheap.
Exactly. And actually, they kind of double down on the kind of diversity instead of focus by increasing the cost of district buildings across the board, too.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, it's kind of countered by reducing the cost of the district itself. But yeah, I mean, the buildings, it's okay. You can buy them with gold anyway.
That's true. I do that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a good method. That's what I do as well. Let's see. Increase cost of districts by 10%, except aerodrome building, which we've kind of talked about in the past as well. I don't really think that sort of percentage changes people's opinions on the aerodrome. Valter, throwing it to you. Are you now a huge aerodrome fan?
To be honest, I'm not sure yet, because some of the changes that are further down the list, I might, but yeah. I don't think I'm a believer yet.
Okay, so you're on the fence. Dan, does that do anything for you before we move on?
Not particularly, but I do think that, I mean, look, 10% of an increased cost of a district building is going to hurt you a lot more early on in the game, say if you're wanting to build a library on a campus, yep. as opposed to later in the game when that's like equivalent to one turn.
I agree. I think that's gonna hit. Spy cost got reduced. Hanging Garden now provides +2 housing. Walls now provide tourism but have no maintenance. Interesting.
Oh, baby. I'm so excited.
What is the purpose of that?
Yeah, I don't get that.
Oh, man. Walls. I love building walls. And this means that I just have more gold to spend in the early game, the moment where I need the gold the most. This is good for the way that I play. And yeah.
But this following point is not good for the way you play. Yes, this is the correct point. Battering ram and siege tower now upgrade to the medic support unit and no longer functional against a city with urban defenses. Woo! I mean, that does what I believe it should do.
They were listening.
Yeah, they're totally listening. Valter, doesn't this one part of the sentence completely negate your sadness, though? They now upgrade to the medic unit?
No, because I never use the medic support unit, unfortunately, and I don't see myself using it now either.
No.
No, this is probably, in my opinion, the biggest point in the patch.
I think so, too.
For me, this completely revamped my entire look on the domination victory, because not only in a later game is the siege tower now a lot worse, but also in the beginning of the game, because now you have to sync production into something that eventually become obsolete. Upgrading to the medic support unit is not good enough. I will count it as obsolete, and I probably will earlier delete it than actually make medic out of it.
Yep.
So this makes the whole war game for me completely different. And I think that's a good thing.
I agree that I think it's a very weird thing to turn it into a medic support unit. I understand they are support class units to begin with. So turning them into like an artillery piece would be, you know, a little bit of a transition and therefore might knock a lot of numbers around in other sections of the game. But turning it into a medic support unit, you're right. It does not feel like it's not really continuing the initial purpose of the unit. You're talking about knocking down walls or getting through walls. The medic support unit doesn't do that. So
yeah, but they had to find something. And if there is something, then this probably would be the best one to turn into. But they were grasping at straws. Like, what do we do with it then? Like, we can't just let it poof go away.
Very true. So gave St. George an additional charge. No idea what that really does, but I don't think I ever use St. George. Updated.
St. George gives you ancient and medieval walls immediately in the city.
Oh, so it's actually tied into that. Okay.
So the reason why they gave him an additional charge is before St. George also removed the maintenance costs for the walls that he immediately built. And so he was debuffed, and they gave him extra buff by giving him an extra charge.
Got it. We also updated Monarchy's medieval wall bonus to plus 50% production towards defensive buildings, plus one housing for each level of wall. So more wall changes. So the walls really got a heavy hit in this batch, I mean, in just different ways. So pros that you like in terms of tourism, but no maintenance. But, you know, you lost your ability to use siege towers in the modern atomic, et cetera, era. Let's see.
Which makes sense.
It still makes sense. This is not only just a buff to walls. This is also, in my opinion, a little bit of a buff to Monarchy. Because the extra production towards defensive buildings, I build those buildings pretty much all the time. Now they provide tourism as well and no cost. Thank you.
And I like Monarchy, so this is a good double down.
I do like Monarchy a lot. That's a great one. Any thoughts on the other two? The Apostle promotion only evicts 75% of existing pressure of other religions, not 100%.
Yes, that it's definitely a thing that was way too overpowered.
Agreed.
Because if you had a city with 20 pops or something in that, you went in there with a proselytizer, poof, it was all gone.
Wow.
And that just was way too powerful. 75% might still actually be too much, but it is definitely a really good nerf.
Yeah, that promotion is BS just across the board before. I remember at least two instances that come to mind where it erased so much effort I had put in to doubling down on religion in an area.
I mean, I loved it if I went for a religious victory. When I saw that guy, I was like, all right, I'm going to go to the biggest city on the map that's not my religion, and it's going to be my religion now.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. But when it goes, I mean, I don't know if I ever used it myself. I'm saying that I had it used against me.
Using it is awesome, but it's a good nerf.
Any thoughts on this next one? With press gangs will now unlock with exploration and native conquest with colonialism.
I don't actually remember what press gangs is.
Neither do I. That's why I was like,
neither do I, actually.
Well,
press gang.
Do you guys
is
want-
it so exploration and native conquest with? Oh, I believe those are CBs.
Press gangs is a military policy. Plus 100% production towards Renaissance and industrial era naval units. So now comes with. What again? This is great. We'll now unlock with exploration.
It makes sense. Exploration, so conceivably a lot earlier then.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then native conquest. Oops. Well, I guess just typing that into. Oh, look. How is that possible? I type native conquest and it's my first result. Thanks, Google. That is combat victories over units from earlier eras provide gold equal to 50. Okay. So that's interesting because this is always a native conquest is a card I have wanted to put in, but I've never really used it because I could never justify kicking another card out that I've had of value.
What's native conquest again? Can you read it out?
Combat victories over units from earlier eras provide gold equal to 50% of the combat strength of the defeated unit.
Oh, I like that. I don't know if I've ever used that, but that sounds pretty viable.
So
especially if you're an early game powerhouse and you get ahead of the other civs quickly.
Note that the activation of this policy depends on the era the attacking unit belongs to as compared to the era of the defending one. So not the era each of the respective civilizations is in currently. Oh, that's an important side note there. So it's unit versus unit, not what eras you're in. So if you could use it for an infantryman to kill a musketman, you would get gold from it because the musketman's lower quality. Interesting.
I mean, it sounds interesting, and to your point, if you're an early game civ, you can't use it because it only unlocks at exploration. So that's near the mid game.
That one's with colonialization or colonialism.
So it pretty much is just useful if you are playing on lower difficulties, because otherwise the AI will be more advanced than you, or at least on par, and you won't get any use out of it. So for me, that's a policy I never use unless I try to play a fun game on the lowest difficulty just to see how bad I can kill the AI.
That makes sense.
And even as a guy that plays on Prince and King more often than not, then I, you know, you can still be above the AI's, you know, tech level. But still, as cool of a concept as the card is, I have never been able to justify bumping something else, you know, out of place for it. It's like, well, again, you have to line up the correct units to duke it out. And then, I mean, you'd have to be fighting a civ that was like way in the past, you know, at least they've invested all their units as something older than you to really feel that impact. But those are interesting that they are working to move some of those cards around. So that'll be cool to see how that works out. I'm interested to see specifically press gangs. We got anti-air strength values go up by 5%. They go up by 5 across the board. Increase destroyer AA strength to match other units of the same era. So we're getting some little anti-aircraft stuff. They're clearly trying to get air combat back on the right path, because later on we're going to talk about how that affects the AIs. Balance change to archer. The cost is plus 10. And the, how do you say the chariot archer's name? The Marianu chariot archer cost is gone down by 20. Combat plus 2. Range strength plus 2. So there you go. Some little balance changes for the archers.
I mean, the change cost to archer, before the patch actually hit and you had that first look video for Nubia, everybody was calculating like, oh, the Nubian archer is more expensive. And even with her bonus, if you produce more, but if you both have the Agoge policy in there as well, actually the other AI will outproduce you with archers because the cost is higher for her. So maybe it's not that great. And then the patch note hit and it was like, the archer just got bumped by 10. So all your calculations were in vain and I'm loving it.
Wah, wah.
I mean,
good old archers.
The archer is a good unit, and having its cost increased by 10, it's okay. I don't think that's a bad thing.
That's not going to change the fact that it's still such a strong unit, especially when you need it to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So last one here for the balance, the just general balance is increased cost to repair city outer defenses. That sounds reasonable to me.
Yeah, they were way too cheap.
Yeah. And then I guess how much do we have left here? We might have to start breezing through some more of these guys for time. So I'm going to call out my big one that I noticed from the civ specific balance changes was Congo is now 50% more great people points rather than double. That makes sense. They were a little bit crazy before, although that was fun to play as him, just not fun to go up against him in the great people race.
True.
What do you guys think about some of these other ones?
Okay, can I just call out that I love what they did for Spain?
Yep.
It seems minor, but the bump from plus 4 to plus 6 on the treasure fleet on international trade route gold, and then the plus 1 to plus 2 science on a mission if it's next to a campus, it's incremental, and it's minor, so to speak. But as someone who's played Spain a couple times, it's the minor stuff that really set them, I felt, off from not being a great civ. I felt like in the right situation, their abilities, and particularly treasure fleet, was good, but it didn't have enough of a buff. And campus was good, but statistically it wasn't enough. So now by increasing just the base stats on those two things, I think it's gonna make a huge difference for Spain players. And I'm actually probably thinking my game against Nubia this week will be another Spain game, just because I'm really excited to try it and see if it is as significant a bonus as I feel it is just reading it.
Makes sense. Personally just really love the thing they did with Norway, that the Stave Church now gives plus one production for all water resources in the city. It's something that Norway really needed, something like that. They also gain extra production, 50% production of naval melee units, which makes a lot of sense for them. And I think this is actually bringing Norway a little bit closer to an okay civ. They were trash tier, and they've gone up A tier at least with that, especially in production for all water resources. That's pretty nifty.
Norway or Spain? Who would you rather?
In any game, Spain is still better, but Norway got a better boost.
Fair enough.
I
also like what they did with Greece, awarding an envoy when they complete the Acropolis, because that makes so much sense. Greece is the place you think of with all the city-states and stuff like that. They need those envoys.
Yeah, I think that's subtly quite good, actually, and that could really snowball for you.
Yeah, that's
Greece
cool.
was already a really good civilization, and this makes them quite a bit better. The Acropolis was not that great of a district, but now it actually becomes so much better, especially because it's a special district, so that means it's 50% cheaper than the normal version. And this is a way to generate a lot of envoys really quickly and snowball kind of out of control with that. Really big buff, but I love it mostly because of the thematic thing because it's Greece.
I think it'd be fun. I mean, that could, in some small way, really change how they deal with city-states across the board, which is what it's supposed to do. But, I mean, that can blow up into a larger game sort of thing. It actually makes me want to try playing a very city-state hoarding sort of game with Greece and see just how many you can get, you know, with those extra bonuses in there.
Yeah, build that wonder that gives you more envoys and then just go nuts.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's too bad that diplomacy isn't a viable victory type right now. But when it is, this clearly sets Greece up in the right direction for that.
Agreed.
Depending how it works, indeed.
So Catherine's Flying Squadron now awards for a spy when the extra capacity is earned at castles. All spies start as agents with a free promotion. That's cool. Good for you, Catherine.
That is really nice.
As a resident spy guy.
Are you rushing to play France, though?
Well, France is not the worst out there. And all their spies starting as agents with a free promotion is actually pretty good. That is actually because spies are strong, and I still feel that most people underestimate how cool spies are in the game. And that's why my first strategy session was on spies. And this makes them a lot stronger.
Well, there you go. Spy improvements. Okay, quickly running through some of these. You guys stop me if you have something to say. Map generation. Aluminum now appears in planes. Increased lake generation. Updated bonus and strategic sea resource generation. Inland sea maps now have rivers. Woo!
Increased lake generation. I felt like there's enough water to drown an entire map usually when I'm playing the game. So that'll be interesting to see.
The thing was that most of them were like too large, so they didn't count as a lake anymore.
That's a good point.
I think they've increased the amount of lakes that can spawn, but made the amount of tiles that they spawn smaller, so they actually are counting as lakes instead of like inland seas.
That is a good point, because I tried to build that wonder once, the Aztec wonder, whatever it's called, the Huey Tecal, whatever, and it was yeah, I don't have it in front of me, so there's no way I'm recalling the full name. But tried to build it, and it was an inland sea, and I'm like, this not an inland sea. This is clearly what should be a lake. So that actually would probably fix that sort of thing.
Yeah.
UI enhancements added a turn blocker notification when a city ranged attack is available, which is good. Combat preview UI has received multiple improvements. The Civilopedia now shows the number of spies and envoys granted by a civic. Multi-turn units movement paths shown when unit selected. Add relationship tab to city-state intel reports, which display that the city-state's at war. Which displays that city-states at war status with other civs and city-states.
That's a good one. I do think there were mods that did that, so it's nice to see that built in now.
I can agree with that. A pop-up box is now used to modify deal of item values. That sounds useful. Added leader dialogue for gifts and demands. Scenarios no longer display extraneous UI screens. Reports now display great works, adjacency, and district information. I like this next one here as well. Trade route chooser automatically selects previously completed trade route. Thank you. Instead of picking it from like 20. Additional improvements to the trade route chooser. I had a mod on
not
for it yesterday.
Not enough. Just the fact that you can't sort on the specific type, that's a big no-no. The mods have done that since the beginning of the game. They did improvements to the trade route chooser, but didn't do that. I think they dropped the ball on that one.
That's unfortunate, but I do. I think I'm going to be in agreement from what I've seen online. I was kind of saying I had a mod that was still running and kind of covered that up yesterday, so I couldn't tell exactly what all had changed. But let's see.
AI, it's a bit more clearer.
Oh, I almost skipped a section. Diplomacy enhancements. Added tooltips explaining why you can or cannot declare each kind of war or undertake another diplomatic action. Are you sure you
want to... I really, really like that one, actually.
Do you?
Because now you can see the different cost belly that you could use to declare war and how much warmongering that would give you.
I like that.
And even if it's not available, instead of only the ones that are available to you to actually do right now. So that's really useful.
That's a great point, because my lack of understanding of how the casus belli and stuff work and how to achieve some of them, I actually don't use that system at all. Like, I've completely just ignored the warmonger system in Civ 6. I'm just like, whatever, if I'm going to go to war with you, I'm going to go to war with you. So, and it's always like a formal war anyway. Or, yeah, I think it's always like a formal war for me. That's the only option I ever have. So that'll be interesting to actually get in there and see what I need to do and then kind of give me the steps to go about it. And are you sure you want to denounce confirmation added? I think that's a good one, because I think I've hit that button before on accident trying to make like a trade deal. So, damn, I was just going to be your friend. I guess we're not friends now. Liberation changes. Liberating cities can now occur even if you got the city in a deal. Peace deals are the most common case of that. There's a case where the Persian player didn't see the seed or return. Besides, cities on the peace deal screen has been fixed. When you liberate a city-state, your military units are only kicked back from the first ring of hexes around the city. You aren't ejected from the territory entirely. That sounds sensible. Okay, this is the one I want to spend like a minute on here in AI tuning. Improved AI ability to move great works around to get theming. That's great. This one. AI will now better handle air attacks. Bombers will attack districts, improvements, and then units in that preference order. Fighters will prefer to attack other air units. Hallelujah, you're actually making the units be used in the way they're supposed to be used. So,
still have to see them using air units, though.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see if this actually does change it in fact.
My fingers are crossed, seeing as it feels like a whole section of the game that's underutilized, but I want that to work out. Improve their desire to pillage cities, improve city planning with regard to adjacency bonuses during city attacks, concentrate unit attacks on more threatening units rather than spreading out, fixed a bug that resulted in the AI overestimating the value of demand tribute. Anything else from this list? I feel like I'm just reading to everybody. Anything else you guys want to call out from the AI tuning?
How about that last one? Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
The fact that the adjustment of the acceptance of embassies and everything like that, and the delegations, is actually a pretty big thing, because a lot of people have always been nagging, like, it's so difficult to stay friends with the AI. And this is one of the ways that you get friends with the AI. And that should become a lot easier for a lot of people now. And I hope that this will mean that people are not at war with everybody all the time anymore.
Good point.
Yeah, how about the last one on that list? As a player approaches victory, AI will become less friendly and more aggressive. If that's a significant change insofar as we actually see a difference there, I think that's huge. That'll remove those anticlimactic games where, you know, you swap them off in the early ages and then later on in the game, they're just, you know, they're too afraid of you to do anything. I want them to be more aggressive against me when I'm nearing a victory. I don't want it to just be me sleepwalking towards a science victory, as it sometimes feels like it is.
Good point.
Yeah, definitely. The point is, I need to see how much it will happen. but I expect it will be like a negative modifier on their like relationship with you, which can be offset by being the same government and those kinds of things. But if it actually works the way it looks like it, that could be a really big thing. And you can put alliances against each other.
Johan on YouTube comments and says, I honestly hope they won't make it too easy to make friends with the AI. I think those two points actually tie together here. The embassy and such making it easier to be friends, but at the same time, they're going to become less friendly and more aggressive as you get closer to your goal. So I think that's an interesting little balance. At least it should be.
I don't think it will make it too easy to make friends with the AI because you need this. The embassy and stuff like that to actually get to a point where you can become friends. And most people didn't even get to that point. So this will make it possible to become friends, but won't not make you automatically become friends. You still have to do the things they like with their agenda and stuff like that and make trade deals. But this will actually give you a possibility before he shuts you down because you're stupid from the beginning of the game.
Let's see. Multiplayer got some stability after receiving join error. So I know a lot of other people had issues with multiplayer games out there. So say the subreddits. But I guess hopefully that helps people out. And then what else? I wanted to call out. Actually, was there anything else in bug fixes I cared about here? Oh, I like the idea that coastal raids can be used to explore tribal villages on shores. I didn't really realize that was a huge bug issue, but yeah, that's a thing. So that's cool. Go Norway. You guys can use that.
I like the thing with the district repair cost now computed properly based on both game speed and start era. I've seen a lot of people complaining on the Reddits about it, like, how the hell can it cost me 40 turns to repair my district? This should not be a thing. And this should be the correct way.
Good. Dan, any last comments on that?
There was one that I was looking at, but I lost it. Where the heck did it go?
Also, there's a new visual for mountains while you look for it, for desert mountains, I should say.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Sorry. Wonders should always be repairable after they have been hit by a nuclear blast.
Yeah.
I don't feel like that's an actual hands-on change. I think that's a bit of a meme-y change, a bit of a trolley one on Praxis's part, but kind of funny. I mean, yeah, so I guess that in actuality, if you nuke the pyramids, they'll still be repairable? Is that what that's telling me?
I mean, you could take a bunch of stone and build the pyramid again.
Radioactive stone, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, something like
you
that.
You can ship it away from some other place or clean it up with your legionary soldiers and stuff like that.
That's
whatever,
right.
Whatever floats your boat, my dude.
That's right. You can use your legions to do that grunt work.
Yeah.
So, with all that covered, I'm very excited. This is a lot of cool changes coming to the game in terms of these little tweaks here and there. But not all has been rosy and great. There's been a lot of people that have had trouble with it, people with crashing games. It basically comes down to mods for the most part. So if you are someone that has been having issues with it, if your game isn't loading a certain feature or you're getting any sort of crashing glitches, make sure you're disabling all your mods. And Valcher, am I right in saying you went so far as to revalidate your game files?
Yeah, so I had the problem that when I loaded the game up first, I had just like the blank screen with no UI, couldn't close out or anything like that. What I did was unsubscribe from all the mods on the Steam Workshop, re-verify my game files, and after that it worked like a charm, had no crashes whatsoever. That's the thing with updates like this. Mods aren't immediately updated as well, and it might look like, oh, but the changes don't have anything to do with the mod files, but usually there are some file changes, a couple of lines got moved around and breaks everything. So you just disable all the mods until you know for certain that your mod has been updated for this version of the game.
That sounds very, very reasonable. Speaking of lines, I know you're talking about lines of code. Copper Cutters, one of our good friends of the show, commented and said that he was having an issue. I just had to read out part of his email because he turned to us for help. You know you're desperate when you email us saying, help, I don't know who else to go to. So thank you. And I'm so glad that you got that fixed on your Reddit post that you commented. Seemed to be a mod issue. So there you go. Take out those mods, revalidate files if you need to. You can revalidate them through the Steam menu. So should be easy. And in the essence of time, I'm going to kick it to you guys for your little your minutes of the week here. Dan, do you want to take it away with your historical minute?
Sure. So I know squat about Amanitore and the Nubians as a civilization. I was doing a little bit of research on them, though, and they are actually quite fascinating. And once again, props to Firaxis for weaving in a lot of historicity and a lot of really cool little nuggets for us history buffs into their building of this civ. So her leader ability is Kandake of Meroe, which is a butchering of it. But a Kandake in the ancient Nubian civilization is a term for queen. But Kandakes weren't just queens insofar as being, you know, your kind of figurehead or ceremonial leader. A Kandake was an extremely powerful position within a hierarchy. So the queen mothers would rule until their sons were of age to rule, and then they would appoint whichever son they wanted to rule as king, as the king and as the ruler. But they still held a level of real power in the kingdom, even after naming their son as king. So the Kandakes could at any point depose their sons and take their sons off of the throne if they felt that they were mismanaging the throne, even going so far as to ordering the king to commit suicide so as to not create some sort of dynastic struggle or some sort of deposed kingship or something like that. I don't know if Amanitore actually did that with any of her sons. I don't think so, because Amanitore is known as the warrior queen, and her royal palace at Gebel Barkal, which is now, by the way, a world wonder in the game. I don't think we mentioned that. I think we can talk about that next week. It's a UNESCO heritage site. It's not some big, her actual tomb is not some big grand like pyramid or anything like that. It's just a squat little 6 meter, 6 meter square pyramid, tomb rather. So it's actually quite tiny. But from everything I've read about her, in the brief time that I've had a chance to do a bit of research on her, she seems like a pretty formidable figure, in Nubian history. And for those of you who might be wondering where Nubia is, in relation to modern day, most of the Nubian Empire is in modern day Sudan. And that is where she is buried at the Naka. No, she's not buried at the Naka Lion Temple. Sorry, she's buried at a temple in Meroe, which is in modern day Sudan. But yeah, it's fascinating, man. You know, these empires, when you read about these really ancient empires, and maybe people don't know a lot about of, you know, generally it's the ones that are maybe in Central Asia or in Africa or in South America. There's just such a rich and hundred year history for these empires that we know so very, very little about, and there's little documentation of it. But Amanitore is one of the few leaders from the Nubian Empire who is very, very well documented in their history, even going so far as to have carvings in a very kind of ornate, almost hieroglyphic style on her tombs. So fascinating, imposing historical figure from a really interesting civ who I might try and find a little bit more about as the weeks go by here, just because I know so little about them.
Very good. Props for Firaxis to actually choosing this if I love it, because like you said, it is a thing that makes us learn more. And we've seen that every time and again when they release one of these DLC or one of a name, the Google hits just spike up so far of people looking up like, who is this person actually? And making them go out and learn more of these kinds of histories, I think that's a good thing for everybody.
Yeah, for
like
sure.
Dan said, good choice. A strong warrior woman. Good way, yeah. Good progressive Firaxis. Like, love it. Love it, love it,
yeah,
love it.
For sure.
Valter, what do you have on tap for us this week in your strategy tip?
So let's talk a little bit more about Nubia. Next week, we're going to go more in depth of like all the pros and cons, but I just want to do a short rundown in what I see as her strong points and her weak points. And we can discuss that more in next week, because I'm pretty sure you guys will have some different opinions about it than I do. So starting with the Kandake of Meroe, I like it. It's a really good ability, extra production towards all districts, 20% extra production towards all districts, which makes you build districts everywhere. So that's really good. But then you have the plus 40 if there is a Nubian pyramid adjacent to the city center instead of the plus 20. And that is a point for discussion, for me at least. I think it's actually really bad. You need to put it on desert hill or floodplain. So that means you either are by accident have a desert hill or desert plain next to your city center or a floodplain. If it's a floodplain, don't build the Nubian pyramid there. There are way better things you can put there, like a farm. And because the pyramid itself doesn't give that much yield. If it is on a desert tile itself, then it could be useful, but you don't generally want to have those desert tiles. So it's really incidental that it happens, actually. And on a desert hill, it's the exact same thing. And if you have a lot of desert hills, then you want to have a lot of mines on there, build the Petra, and get the Ruhr Valley. So the Nubian Pyramid, it sounds really good, but like most abilities that give you a special improvement, I don't think it's actually that great, which is sad because I wanted it to be great. But she has a lot of upsides as well beyond that. Her special unit, the Patati Archer, really, really great. The fact that the extra strength, and it is only a little bit more expensive than a normal archer, but the best part, of course, is the extra movement. Movement is so important in this game, like we've talked about so much time, especially with the chains in Civ 6, that you need to have the full movement to go to the next tile. So if you want to move on a hill, you need to have two movement available. Now, this unit can move one tile on a plane and two moves on a hill. Or, even better, you move on the hill and you can still shoot. That's a huge upswing for her. That makes the unit so much more versatile. And the extra XP that it gives you as well will make sure that if you build a couple of them in the beginning of the game, that by the time you're getting crossbows, you have fully upgraded crossbowmen with literally all the promotions. And those are very, very dangerous. Combining that with her power that all range units, production towards range units get a 50% bonus, man, this girl can, I know she's a warrior queen, but this girl really knows how to fight. and that goes on for the entire game. So throughout the entire game, you will be pumping out more range units than all your other enemies. And that can win wars, especially now that siege towers will not be able to do the damage anymore. That is just really, really powerful. The mines of strategic resources, it's nice if they have it, but it's incidental. You don't really plan for it. Same for the luxury resources. It's nice if it happens, but it's incidental and you can't really get much out of it. So that bonus I would on the play a little bit. All in all, she's top tiers. She can, not the top tier, but at least very high in there, in my opinion. Good addition.
I'm a huge fan of her already. I think this is fantastic. Thank you very much, Valter, for your overview of it. Can't wait to dive into those more next week. Dan, thank you so much for the history. Hope you can dig up a little bit more. If there's more to dig, I don't know. She seems kind of mysterious. It's one of those little histories that's gone by the wayside, kind of.
Yeah. We'll find something. We'll definitely find something. I am curious to see where Valter places her in his tier list next week, for sure.
That'll be good. Yeah. That'll be very good. Well, thank you, everyone that was able to come and hang out in our YouTube, Twitch, Mixer, live chat. Those are brought to you, our whole live stream experience is brought to you by our awesome supporters over at Patreon. We appreciate you guys so much. Our donations went up this last week, I think aiming us towards the new goal we announced, where I'm going to go back and live stream playthroughs of Civ 4 and the older Civ games that you can still snag on Steam and such. So that's going to be very exciting. I think we have people trying to skyrocket us to that goal. So go ahead and check that out. That's patreon.com/CivCast. You can find links to that. You can find links to any of our live streaming sites, all of that over on the main website, which can be found at civcastpodcast.com. And you can go there. There's going to be a link to the Civcast page. There's a page in particular that has all of our links to everything you could ever want, including iTunes and Android subscribe links and what else. Oh, we have a link to our Discord where we encourage you guys to go and hang out. We've been getting more and more people hopping over to Discord every week, so that's been really cool. Resender is a huge poster over there. Appreciate all his work a lot. We're just in different time zones, but go chat, everybody. Go hang out. You guys are doing such a good job over on the Reddit, which, so there's a reminder, that is civcast.reddit.com. We love seeing all of your posts there. There's going to be some news. We're doing the book club, which, Dan, do you want to kind of remind people what's going on with the book club?
Book club is a monthly thing where at the start of the month, we will post a historical, semi-civ related, although loosely, book that Wouter is up on or is hyped on or is interested in. And we'll read it during the month. And then at the end of the month, we encourage you to post about it. Wouter and I are going to hop on the Reddit this week and write out like a review of it or some interesting stuff we learned from it. And then we're also going to do, for patrons at the $1 tier, we're going to do a 15 to 20 minute just rundown on the book itself and just our thoughts on it, stuff we learned from it, interesting points. This month's book was by Frank Decotter, the great Chinese historian, and it was the Cultural Revolution, a history basically of the Cultural Revolution in China in the 20th century, which is something I'm personally studying for teaching this coming year. So it was a personal interest and one that came highly recommended, and one that so far I'm almost done it has been really, really interesting and really good.
Awesome. So yeah, that's a 15 to 20 minute MP3 you guys will get over there on Patreon. So that'll be really, really cool. Speaking of that, Valter's got his strategy session turned in for the month of July. So you guys can expect that. We're going to put that up there tomorrow because tomorrow's the 31st. So we can still get it in under the wire. You guys will be able to enjoy that. We have all our cold opens to the shows going up there. So all of our like 15-ish minute chats we do before we actually go live or get the episode that you're hearing right here now. Those are all going up to Patreon as well. And I guess the last shout out is to go check out our friends at nontoxicgaming.com, making the internet a cooler and more friendly place to go and hang out and chat with one another. So big props to them, nontoxicgaming.com. Guys, that does it for this week. Another episode under our belt, episode 43, with some awesome content. And we'll be back next week to go dive even deeper into Nubia. Until next week, just one more turn. You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. For more shows like this, visit kyledempsterstudios.com.